Anything Ghost, number 277. Welcome to Anything Ghost. My name is Lex Wall. Anything Ghost is a place where people share their personal paranormal experiences, aka ghost stories, and I read them to you over the show. If you have one you want to share, you can either type it up or record it and send it to Lex at anythingghost.com. I have some creepy stories for you today, including a very haunted house in Franklin, New Jersey, called the Van Wickle House. That and more coming your way in number 277. Okay, I'm going to start off with the unhappy child ghost at the Van Wickle House in New Jersey, U.S. The Simon Van Wickle House is located at 1289 Easton Street in Franklin, New Jersey. Simon Van Wickle and his wife Dinah built the house in 1722. Those who have stayed at the house, either as owners or docents, say the Van Wickle House is haunted by at least one ghost. The most popular is believed to be, according to a psychic, the ghost of a 13-year-old girl. She was the daughter of one of the later owners of the house, Hendrik Sudam. Hendrik bought the home in 1793, where he and his wife raised three children. However, earlier in her life, his wife passed away, leaving Hendrik alone to raise his three daughters. Records of the 13-year-old girl ghost go back as far as 1938. In that year, someone took a photo of the ghost. It shows the image of what appears to be a teenage child peeking out from behind a wall near the fireplace. I'll have that photo posted on anythingghost.com under this link for episode number 277. Decades later, in the 1970s, a couple spent their first years of marriage in the house, prior to the property being taken over and cared for by the Meadows Foundation in the late 1970s. The couple were Matt and Leslie Curran. Matt was working on a degree in forestry at the nearby Cook College, and Leslie was studying to be a nurse while they were living at the Van Wickle House. They had a few scary experiences with the young girl ghost while they were staying there. On one occasion, the couple was walking through the downstairs apartment area of the house when they both heard Matt's name called out. Matt said he'd also heard his name called out on several other occasions while he was doing carpentry work on the outside of the house. Leslie was also experiencing paranormal things there. She was pregnant at the time of this story, and because of the morning sickness, she didn't want to go to work one day. While she was lying in bed, she witnessed a woman in white appear at the foot of the bed. She covered her head with a pillow, and when she looked back, it was gone. Shortly after that encounter, the couple decided to move. In the late 1970s, the house became under the care of the Meadows Foundation. A former township manager of the old house, Harry Gherkin, who lived in the upstairs apartment for 5 years, said his first experience with the ghost happened on a Memorial Day weekend. He came back late from dinner and turned off the lights in his room. Within a few minutes, he heard a horrendous screaming. His first thought was that the screaming was coming from outside, but when he looked out the window, all was quiet and undisturbed. The following morning, Harry Gherkin got up and went downstairs. In the kitchen, he saw a very heavy potted plant that had been sitting on a windowsill, smashed in the middle of the kitchen floor. The heavy plant had to have been moved 6 feet from the windowsill to the middle of the kitchen floor. During his time there, on several occasions, Harry Gherkin also heard screams, odd door knockings coming from the door knocker, and the rattling of dishes. Harry's wife also had some scary experiences with the ghost. One afternoon, after entering the smaller anteroom, she could tell the ghost was in there. Feeling uncomfortable in the room, she told the ghost, "I'm only here to grab something from the file cabinet." After that, she felt a hand on her back. But it wasn't scary, it was in kind of a reassuring manner. After I found the story of this house, I told my friend Al Robber about it. I've spoken to Al on previous episodes. I even did an interview with him on Anything Ghost. It was about 10 years ago. And it was about the haunted Lizzie Borden house. And Al Robber is a renowned paranormal investigator, and he's been on numerous TV shows regarding ghosts and paranormal investigations. After I told him about the haunted stories behind the Van Winkle house in New Jersey, he told me he'd done investigations at the house back in the 1980s. And sure enough, I found quotes from Al Robber regarding an investigation in the house which involved Al and a psychic. And when I told Al I was hoping to add these ghost stories at the Van Winkle house to my next Anything Ghost episode, he offered to speak to me on the phone and talk about the investigations that he had at the Van Winkle house. But our conversation was set up so last minute I didn't get a chance to record it, and I wish I could have because Al's great at relaying the old ghost experiences and stories, as well as sharing his knowledge of the paranormal. But here it goes. In the early 1980s, Al Robber was in an organization known as Vestigia. It formed in 1976 and consisted of scientists, engineers, technicians, and interested individuals who would investigate and conduct research into unexplained, anomalous, scientific phenomena. They had about 100 members back then, and it was broken down into topics: UFOs, animal mutilations, Bigfoot, and the smallest group, parapsychology. So in November of 1984, Al and a psychic from the Vestigia organization went with a couple others to the Van Winkle house to investigate the haunting. The psychic began feeling the ghost as soon as they entered the home. They walked into the main room of the house, kind of like a large living room, and the psychic said this was her bedroom. After leaving her alone in the room for about 15 minutes, the psychic said there was an adolescent girl who lived there in the 1800s. She said her name was Anne. The girl was wearing a white linen gown with pink trim. She said the girl had an older sister and a younger sister. She also said that the girl, Anne, was an invalid, and from what I understand, it was a psychosomatic illness, and as such, she was unable to help around the farm. Her father would ignore her, as would her two sisters, which made her feel terrible as she laid in the bed, unable to join them in their daily farm chores. As I said earlier, the mother had died at an early age, which left the father to take care of the three girls. Just guessing here, but perhaps Anne's crippling psychosomatic illness was due to the loss of her mother at such an early age. Regardless, everyone in the house would ignore Anne every day and every night, and she was filled with guilt and very unhappy. But there was one person who treated Anne kind. It was a 19-year-old hired helper who would come across the river to work on the farm. He would wave to her, talk to her, laugh with her, and treat her nice. So needless to say, Anne always looked forward to his visits to the house. She knew what time the young man would arrive via the river behind the house, so she would sit at a window at the back of the house and watch for his arrival. But other than those short visits from the farm worker, she would spend lonely, guilt-filled days and nights in the Van Winkle house. Although Anne lived a very unhappy childhood at the home, she didn't die at the house. She actually went on to live a full life. She married and moved to Pennsylvania. But apparently, the guilt treatment her family gave her stuck with her until the day she died. So the psychic said it was Anne who was haunting the place, returning to her childhood home, unable to shed the guilt she felt from when she was a young teenager. I found a few other haunting moments that tenants spoke of regarding Anne's ghost. A group of girls who were at a party in the house said they saw Anne's ghost looking out from the attic window. And they also saw her in the doorway of the kitchen when they came inside for cake. One gentleman who lived there alone had an experience on a snowy evening. As he was walking toward the kitchen door, he heard a rapping on the upstairs attic window. He quickly looked, but didn't see anything. Instead of going inside, he headed back to his car, drove to his girlfriend's house, and spent the night there. If you ever have a chance to visit the Van Wickle home in Franklin, New Jersey, walk around to the back of the house, out by the river. If you hear a tapping on glass, peer up to the window. You may see Anne waiting for the arrival of her farmhand friend. And we're carrying on now with a story from Kelly in New York. Say goodbye. In the 1980s, sometime before living in Brooklyn, New York, I was in my early 30s working for a food co-op as a produce manager and sharing a community house with four other women around my age. It had been a commune-style house since the 1970s, and it was beautiful. It was an old Victorian house built sometime in the 1870s and had beautifully stained and leaded glass windows, amazing dark woodwork with a three-story staircase, and built-in cabinetry everywhere. It was a three-story house that had a third-floor attic room. One of the housemates who lived there the longest occupied that room. There were three more bedrooms on the second floor, one of which I had, and downstairs there was a parlor room with a sliding oak door and a large open living room and a large kitchen. The neighborhood was very diverse, and on one side of our house there were more beautiful Victorian houses, all well kept up and privately owned, with lovely large trees lining the street. But on the other side of the house there were old brick apartments that were on the lower kind of rent, and had noisy occupants residing there. Those apartments were across the street from our house, and there would be loud music, revving of car engines, and yelling all hours of the day and night. Quite a contrasting scene, and our house seemed to be the bordering house of it all. One spring day, I had a day off and was looking forward to going into Manhattan and visit friends. My housemates had all left for the day before me, and I said goodbye to each of them that morning in the kitchen. That afternoon, I sprung out the door in a lively mood. But as I went down the stairs to cross the small yard, I was struck at how eerily quiet it was outside. There were no people yelling or revving of engines or loud music on their boomboxes. There was not even the sound of birds singing that always were present on such a warm spring day. No one was around at all. I opened the gate of the small chain-link fence that surrounded our yard and crossed onto the sidewalk. As I turned left to head toward the train station, I heard a voice say, "Aren't you going to say goodbye, Kelly?" Now, I don't know any guys in the neighborhood, and certainly did not know anyone who would know me by name as well. I felt the weirdest feeling the voice was coming from our house and from above, but I chose to ignore it. Then I thought I was mistaken and that the person was calling out to somebody else who has a name that sounded like mine. I took a few more steps, and once again I heard the voice, this time quite a bit more insistent. At that point, I stopped in my tracks on the sidewalk, but did not turn around. The hair on the back of my neck prickled up, a sensation I had never experienced before in my life, and I don't think I have since. As I processed this, I slowly did turn around, and then the voice called my name again as I was turning. At that point, I looked in the direction that the distinctive voice was coming, which was definitely my house. And as I looked up at the third floor, I saw the small crank windows on the third floor open and then close slightly. That was all. I had a lot of time to reflect on that incident as I made my way on the train into Manhattan. I came to the conclusion that, unless I get some other information from my housemates about a guest being left in the house that day, that was an unearthly experience. That evening, we all congregated in the kitchen to make our meals. I asked each one of my housemates if they had somehow come back to the house before I left, and each of them said no. And then I asked if any of them had a guest stay behind, and they said no as well. I then told them what I experienced, and it was met with some skepticism, as I would have expected, except for one of the housemates who lived on the third floor. She was Mary. She didn't say anything at all, but left the kitchen quite abruptly. Later, I asked another housemate, who was close to Mary, if I had upset her with my story and questions. She said the story most definitely had upset Mary, but she could not say why. Mary had become very closed-mouthed about why she was upset about it, and she could not get her to discuss it at all. This clearly baffled the both of us, and kind of frightened us, too. There were some other strange and frightening incidences that occurred in that fascinating house in the 3 years that I lived there, but none were like the experience I had that day. We all have our guilty pleasures when we enjoy entertainment, whether it be a pop song or a corny movie or TV show. One of mine is watching those old song and dance musicals from the 40s and 50s. But one source of entertainment I feel no guilt about is how much I love to play Best Fiends. Best Fiends, that's friends without the R, Best Fiends, is a match 3 puzzle game. The colorful, personality-filled game has thousands of levels, with new content added constantly. What keeps me coming back to Best Fiends are the colorful, personality-filled characters who help you with their special powers to win each level. And when you least expect it, a new one pops into your list, and you build up his powers as you gather points for each level won. I've been playing for close to a year, and I remember when I first started, I looked ahead at people that were on the levels 2,000 and above. And here I am, already at level 1,000. And if I hit a difficult level after a couple plays, my brain eventually figures out what is needed to beat the level. It's like a light goes on in your head. Oh, I see. And I get the feeling of gratification as I beat the level. At level 1,000, I find I'm surrounded by several other friends playing Best Fiends. And we're all competing to reach the next level as we make our way to Mount Boom. And Best Fiends is boredom's worst nightmare. It's literally right there waiting for you when boredom knocks on your door. Waiting there with thousands of levels to play while you collect them and build them up and make use of their cute, colorful characters. So come compete with me on Best Fiends. Download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends. And carrying on now with a story from Laura in Huntsville, Alabama. Nighttime Visitor. My father's stepmother and her niece live in a townhome in Decatur, Alabama. His residence is in a very nice, quiet area of town. They have lived there about 2 years and have never had any strange experiences that I know of. But also, they're not on the lookout for anything creepy. The townhouse they live in was built approximately in the 1980s. About a month ago, on a Saturday night, my father and his wife were laying in their bed watching a movie. They have two small dogs who always lay with them. The dogs always bark if something comes in the door, but will always quickly settle down if it's their niece, who also lives in the home. Around 11 p.m., the dogs got up and started barking as if someone had come through the front door. They returned briefly afterward and settled in. My father thought nothing of it, figuring it was his niece Cassandra returning home. A moment later, he saw someone lean around the doorframe into the bedroom and then exit. Again, he thought nothing more of it, figuring it was just Cassandra, who thought they were asleep and didn't want to disturb them. But here is where it gets strange. The next morning, my stepmother was in the kitchen, chatting with Cassandra about her night, and made the comment, "You must have had a pretty good time last night, since you came home pretty late." To this, Cassandra replied, "I didn't come home until this morning. I stayed at a friend's house." We have come to the conclusion that my father and stepmother had some kind of ghostly visit that night. If this had been an intruder, the dogs would have definitely made it known that there was a stranger in the house, and it also seems like they would have heard the sound of someone exiting the door or a window. There was nothing out of place in the home, and the front door was locked. This was such an intriguing story to me, because I've heard similar stories of people seeing shadow figures peep around corners. It definitely creeped me out, but also makes me curious as to who this entity could have been. Often, townhomes have many residences over the years, considering many of them are rentals, so there is no telling who this spirit could have been. But it seems like they just wanted to check in on the new tenants. A story from Caitlin in Maine. New Hampshire Ghost Stories. This story took place in my childhood house in New Hampshire. Nothing too crazy happened, but just some odd things here and there that left me with more questions than answers. My house was over 100 years old, and I'm not sure how old the foundation was, but it sat just outside a small city. The first one happened when I had sleepovers. I would invite my friends over, and we'd all sleep downstairs in the living room. In the middle of the night, not exactly sure when, I would hear the silverware drawer open and all the silverware would just start shaking right in the drawer. I could hear them rattling against each other. No one else seemed to hear this, though, or if they did, they never told me. Also in that house, I remember when I walked around upstairs one time with a comb in my hand. I put it down in my drawer on a shelf, and I walked away. I then went into my parents' room. There, on their dresser, was the comb. I swear I put it down in my room. I stopped and literally looked down at my hands, trying to remember if I had mistakenly brought it in. But I was 100% sure I didn't. I ran downstairs to my living room so fast, and I felt like I had something on my heels, inches away from grabbing me. I did that a lot. Ran downstairs to the highly lit area, like someone or something was right behind me. I was never super scared there. I just had a feeling like sometimes my family and I were not really alone. A few more odd things happened. I tend to see shadows out of the corner of my eyes, but my logical mind tends to chalk it up to hair or something else. But who knows? Well, those are my small stories, but they have stayed with me. And here's a self-recorded story from Swayam in Mumbai, India. A haunting at a hilltop hotel.
Hey Lex, I'm Swayam from India. I'm 16 and I've been listening to your amazing podcast for the last 6 months. I'd like to share a dreadful experience that I and my family had in the summer of 2017. Back then, I was a seventh grader, and my family had planned to spend the holidays on a trip to the southern parts of our country. My family consists of my parents and my sister, who's just 5 years younger than me, one of my close friends, who's the same age as I, and his mother also decided to join us. So we booked a two-week group tour with a travel company. Soon after our booking, we were told that our tour would consist of four destinations led by a tour manager and 12 families, including ours, and that we had to fly to the South Indian city of Bangalore to meet our travel companions, from where we would were to travel by a tourist bus for the remainder of our trip. The trip commenced with a positive note. We soon befriended the tour manager and easily got along with the other families that were with us. We spent the first night at a lavish resort that had pretty much everything we could have asked for. A couple of nights pampering at the hotel made us dismiss our initial skepticism of the travel company and left us craving for what awaited us in the days to come. Playing games, watching movies, and sightseeing, the first few days went by without us realizing it. Little did we knew back then that things were about to take turn for the worse. 5 days into the trip, we headed to our next destination, a nationally acclaimed hill station called Ooty. The place was about 280 kilometers from the town that we were then in, so we kind of knew that we had to brace for an awfully long journey. So we started late in the morning and finally stopped for a break at 6 o'clock on reaching the foothills of the hill station after almost 7 hours of incessant travel. That is when our manager got a call from the hotel we had planned to stay at for the next couple of days. Our first blow came when he was told that the reservation of rooms of all the families had been cancelled due to some last-minute issues, and that we had to look for a new hotel when we were a mere hour and a half away from our destination. The tour manager quickly called the travel company and somehow managed to emergency book some rooms at another hotel far atop the hills. All the families quickly rushed onto the bus, and we departed for the last leg of our journey to the hotel. I can still very well recall the very desolate path we took once we had reached the hill station, away from the bustling streets and crowds of tourists. I remember having not seen a single vehicle along the entirety of the path that led us to the hotel. After nearly an hour of driving along the seemingly endless road, we finally reached the hotel at 8 o'clock. As we got off the bus, we were kind of surprised to see that there was no light on the gate except the hotel billboard that read, "La Flora Amberley Resort welcomes you." We went past the gate, only to find ourselves surrounded by two parallel rows of two-story colonial bungalows starting with the reception building. The reception area was a letdown. It was ill-maintained and had a strange odor. The receptionist handed us our keys and we all left for our rooms. My family had been given a room on the first floor of the last bungalow in the row, and my friend and his mother had got a room on the ground floor of the bungalow, just beside ours. As we climbed the stairs that led to our room, we were taken aback by a puddle of water with insects in it, just outside the door. I tried my best not to let my disgust get the better of me. I refrained from complaining and unlocked the door. As I spread the door wide open, we were met by a swarm of moths desperate for the light outside. As we all got in and turned on the lights, we found ourselves in a room that looked more like a shoebox than a hotel condo. It was like a mini kitchen, a living room, a bedroom, and a toilet had been crammed into a single room. And the entire room felt strange in every way imaginable. There were cobwebs everywhere you looked, the paint on the walls had been worn off somehow, and the strangest of all, there were scribblings on the wall in a local language that I didn't understand, all unintelligible gibberish to me. The place was certainly the worst thing for a hotel room one could possibly imagine, a massive downgrade from the hotels we had stayed at until then. We all dreaded the prospect of having to stand in that room even for a moment, but we didn't have much of an option. We were already running low on time as we had to meet everyone for dinner at 9 o'clock, so we quickly freshened up and left the room and headed to the dining hall. Things felt a little better when, at the buffet, we interacted with other families who, strangely enough, were not quite as dissatisfied with their rooms as we were. When the dinner was over and we had to head back to our room, I, for a brief moment, felt the urge to sleep in the bus. Such was the repulsive nature of our room. Back in the room, things once again got gloomy as they did before. Something felt very odd about that room. My parents had been arguing over petty things ever since we entered the room. About half an hour later, I and my sister were lying on the bed. My sister was almost asleep, and I was scrolling through my Instagram feed. My mom was also in the bedroom, arranging our clothes in the mini wardrobe. That's when a series of knocks on the window right behind our bed interrupted us from our activities. Alarmed by the knockings, my mom asked Dad, who was in the living room on a telephone call with the hotel staff, to come and check out. He quickly hung up the receiver and came in to check what the fuss was all about. The knocking still hadn't stopped. My dad rushed to the window and pushed aside the curtains, only to discover that the window was open. Expressionless, my father shut the window and headed back to the living room. A few minutes went by without anyone saying anything. When came the time for us to sleep? It was 11:30 already, and we had to get up early the next day, as we had a lot of places to visit. My mother was still wary of what had happened a while ago and suggested that we all slept in the same bed together. Anyway, there wasn't much of a hygienic place for us to sleep in the room, so we all agreed. So we turned off all the lights, and all four of us somehow managed to cram ourselves into the small bed. My mother set the alarm on her phone and soon set it aside. It had probably not been even 10 minutes since we lay on the bed that there was a really weird sound in the room, which at first I wasn't quite able to comprehend since I was half asleep. I felt my mother, who was sleeping right beside me, shake me and my father. "Did you hear that? Where did that sound come from?" she asked. "Might be a scooter or some other vehicle out there," I said. I don't know why I said that, but I guess I was too tired and drowsy to think of anything else at that time. Just a few seconds later, there was yet another sound, a squeal of sort. Only this time it was much louder, yet not loud enough to fully awaken my half-asleep and confused self. I felt my mother wake my father up again. They turned on the lights and took a stroll across every room, but didn't wake me up. Lights were off again, and I felt them come back. We had slept for about half a minute that a deafening shriek echoed across the bed. It sounded as if someone was using a drill machine and screaming in agony at the same time. It lasted about 5 seconds. I was wide awake now and felt shivers run down my spine. Before I could react, though, my father flinched and sat up straight on the bed. "What did just happen?" my mother shouted as she got up. All the while, my father sat still and I could hear him gasp. My mom sprang out of her bed and rushed to turn on the lights. Once the lights were on, I was astounded to find that my father was weeping. Yeah, we were all terrified by what had happened, but crying isn't something I'd seen my father do before. He's the kind of person who doesn't get scared easily, but here he was, gasping and weeping endlessly. My mom tried her best to comfort him, but all the while he kept muttering, "This place is cursed." I and my mother just stared at each other, dumbstruck by what had just happened. No matter how ridiculous it sounded, something was certainly wrong with the room we were in. Panicked and awestruck, she picked up my father's phone and tried calling our tool manager and my friend's mother, but there was no network in his phone. She ran to the living room to use the telephone, but even the telephone, which my father had used not so long ago, was dead. Yeah, I know it sounds kind of cliche, but that's just the way it happened. It felt surreal for a moment. Fortunately, my mom's phone worked, and she told both of them to come immediately and that strange things were happening. First came the tool manager, followed by my friend's mother. They both looked on with puzzling expressions as my mother explained what had happened. The tool manager too tried to comfort my father, who had still not recovered from the shock of the incident. After drinking some water, he calmed down a bit. What he said afterwards left us all baffled and terrified. We all could see him watery-eyed and trembled with fear as he explained. He told us that he had double-checked that every window was slammed shut before leaving for the dinner, and that there was no way for the heavy French window behind our bed would have opened on its own. He didn't want to scare us, so he hadn't told us back then. He also said that he had a very strange feeling as he lay on the bed and the sound started. "We better leave this dreadful place right away," he said as he finished explaining. It was well past midnight, and there was no way we could have found a new place to stay yet. My friend's mother suggested that we move to her room, and we all agreed. With her and the tour manager's assistance, we quickly stuffed our items into our suitcases and left the room for good. The tour manager locked the room and followed us into my friend's mother's room. We were a little surprised to find that their room was in a much better condition than ours. The walls were painted red and the floor had a carpet on it. As we sat there, we all tried to calm ourselves down and tried our best to look at the situation rationally, but the incident that had just occurred defied all forms of logic. There was no way for anyone to have not heard the loud shriek we had while we were in the bed. Yet both the tour manager and my friend and his mother declined to have heard anything. And that spooked us even more. Even the tour manager was so baffled by the look on my father's face that he decided to spend the rest of the night with us. He and my father slept on the extended couch while the rest of us slept on the mattress we had laid on the floor. After all, no one had the nerve to sleep on the bed, even if it was in another room. That night was a difficult one. My mind was filled with recollections of the past, and even the slightest movements outside invoked disturbing thoughts. Fortunately, our tour manager snored all night, and I must say, his snoring did offer some solace, for we were able to doze off without worrying much about the strange movements outside. The next morning, my parents and the tour manager woke up early and ventured into the back side of the house we had left last night. The window behind the bed was closed and it was mostly grassland across the back side, except for a very old well. The well, my parents later said, appeared to be dysfunctional as the water looked pretty dark and unfit to drink. I don't know if the well had anything to do with our last night's experience, but it felt very strange. The tour manager told us that we had no option but to spend another night in our friend's room, as it was unlikely that we were going to find a room anywhere else. When we went to the dining hall for our breakfast, something even weird awaited us. The backside of all the houses was visible from the dining room window. That's when the tour manager noticed that the window, which not so long ago was slammed shut, was wide open now. My dad told the tour manager not to mention this to anyone, as we didn't want to attract any unnecessary attention of any of the other families out there. I still hear sure my father that he talked to the hotel manager about the incident in private afterwards. We were about to leave for the day's sightseeing when our bus's engine just won't start. Ever since we had checked into that hotel, unfortunate things just won't stop occurring. The tour manager had to arrange for another small bus as the repairs took longer than expected. We went to many other places that day, but the thought of returning to the hotel at the end of the day had us filled with a sense of dread all day long. We returned at around 7 in the evening and refrained from even looking at our old room. The rest of the schedule was just like the day before. We had our dinner, except this time we returned to our friend's room with the tour manager, who had agreed to sleep with us that night as well. Once we were in the room, he told us that he had had an argument with the hotel manager as he refused to believe in our story. The hotel manager, he said, suspected that we were lying and that no guest had ever experienced anything strange in the hotel. He said that the hotel manager didn't even believe in the window incident as there were not any spare keys for anyone else to have got into the house to fiddle with the windows. It infuriated us all, but that night was our last at the hotel and we were keen on getting the hell out of the place, so we didn't think much about the hotel manager and slept the night. The next morning at breakfast, we were dumbstruck when we found that the bedroom window was now closed, but we didn't bother to think of how it might have happened, for we were happy that we were finally leaving the hotel that morning. We had two more destinations and about 4 days remaining of the trip. The rest of the trip went by normally, but we had lost all our interest and barely enjoyed anything afterward. To this day, my father gets very disturbed every time he tries to explain to someone what had happened that night. I still couldn't think of a more logical explanation for the night's incident. And yet, I still wish to someday pay another visit to the place and make sense of the incident. You guys can check the place out on the internet. It's called La Flora Amberley Resort. Thank you very much for allowing me to share this experience of mine with you, the listeners. Take care.
When things get busy putting together my podcasts, it's always a great relief to see America's number one meal kit, HelloFresh, sitting on my doorstep waiting to be opened so I can see what wonderful meals I'm about to enjoy. Plus, it means no trip to the market or standing in line at said market. These HelloFresh recipes only take about 30 minutes to get them to your table. HelloFresh offers 23-plus recipes featuring a range of flavors, cuisines, and ingredients, so you'll never get bored. Try something new every week. There's something for everyone with HelloFresh, including low-calorie, vegetarian, and family-friendly recipes every week. I've been vegan most of my life, and the latest HelloFresh recipe I tried was the chickpea-powered Mediterranean couscous meal. I was looking forward to the latest recipe, knowing that over 90% of the fresh ingredients were directly from growers. After opening the meal kit, which, by the way, is made almost entirely from recyclable or already recycled content, I took the fresh vegetables, spices, and sauces out of the bag and followed the sample instructions. In no time, the house began filling with an aroma of the HelloFresh recipe. One of the neighbors even commented later that night on the wonderful dinner we must have had. Sooner than you can ever imagine, we were sitting and enjoying the Mediterranean couscous dish. Believe me when I tell you, you have to give America's number one meal kit a try. You will love the time and money HelloFresh saves you on eating fresh, homemade meals, along with the flexibility of being able to change delivery days and food preferences, or adding extras like garlic bread. To get you started with HelloFresh, here's a special Anything Goes offer. Go to HelloFresh.com/anything10 and use the code anything10 for 10 free meals, including free shipping. HelloFresh.com/anything10 and use the code anything10 for 10 free meals, including free shipping. HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit. And I'm going to end the show with reaching back into the archive several years. And this was very popular when it came out, and you're about to see why. He's quite a character. And I get a lot of requests to replay this one, so I'm going to do it now. And it's from Lee in Delaware, The Haunted Truck.
Hello, Lex and listeners. This is Lee from Delaware. I'm a truck driver. And Lex, I found your podcast about a week ago. And I enjoy it a lot. It's kind of hard sometimes finding an interesting enough podcast out there, but I found yours, and you do great work, and keep it up. I've got a story that I can share with you. It's about a haunted truck, nonetheless. I know you've all seen Christine, and this isn't on that kind of level, but it was weird in my little world just the same. This goes back to July of 2004. I was sitting at home for a couple of months. I took about a three-month hiatus from over-the-road driving, just because it was at the time burning me out, and needed time to sit around and think. I had a friend call me. We worked together at a company back in 2000, and since then he went on to follow his dream, and he took over his father's business, running tow trucks and a recovery service out of Nashville, Tennessee. I was surprised to hear from him, and we were catching up and this, that, and the other thing, and he goes to asking me if I wanted a one-time recovery job. And I asked him what it all entailed, and he told me basically, you know, it's not a repo or anything. There's no risk of life and limb on this one. It's just go get this truck that he promised a friend of his who bought it that, you know, he'd go recover it and bring it back to Nashville. He had no other drivers to call on to do it over a weekend, so. If you got the right price, and which he did, so I jumped on my bike and I headed down to Nashville. I get down there, I meet up with him, he gives me keys to the wrecker rig, and he gives me directions, the details of the truck. It was what I was looking for was a 1976 Kenworth. Kind of ironic because me and the truck were born the same year. But it seemed like it was going to be fun enough because you don't see too many of that age around anymore. So I get the truck ready and I head on down to southeastern Louisiana. Not quite on the water, but out in the bayou nonetheless. I mean, nothing but country dirt roads everywhere you looked. And not a lot of room with 70 feet of truck, I'll give it that. But finally found the driveway I was supposed to be looking for. And wiggled it on to the driveway and wiggled up the driveway about a half a mile, which looked like it was going to dead end for a while, but I eventually came to this clearing out in the swamp, little clapboard house, and there's the truck sitting right next to it. Couldn't believe the shape this thing was in. I mean, it was immaculate. It looked like it just drove off the showroom floor. I felt kind of bad. I had to drag it up on a trailer instead of hooking it up to one. But a little old lady comes out of the house to greet me. She's got a folder in her hand with the title and all the shop work. She sat there chatting with me as I was loading it up and chaining it down, and revealed to me that her husband, Henry, had owned the truck, and that was his pride and joy since he bought it new in 76. He had passed a year prior in it on his way back home. He was a mile and a half away from home. They found him in the truck. It was sitting gently on the shoulder of the road, running. The brakes weren't even set. And she went on to tell me at night on Tuesday nights, which was usually when he would leave, the radio would come on and play his Cajun music station out of New Orleans. I took it for what it was worth. It was, you know, old lady looking for somebody to talk to and everything else. I was really not the believer that I am now. But, again, you know, haunted houses, maybe, haunted truck, nah, come on. She gives me the folder. She sets me up with a thermos full of coffee and a couple cornbread muffins to go. I thank her for it. And I get back in the truck and I work my way on back out of the bayou around 9 o'clock at night. I haven't seen too much that is as eerie as the deep southern swampland in the middle of summer at night. And you get that. Well, I certainly felt that whole voodoo mystique and beings, or spirits rather, present. On with the story anyway. I got it back toward Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and I had to take some time, pull it over, go get a shower, and pick up a couple tools and odds and ends I was going to need. And I pull in there, and a bunch of drivers pile out of their trucks that were there already and see, you know, watching me pull in with this old relic. I got it parked and went over to the driver next to me and gave him a 20 spot to make sure nobody stole it or took anything off of it. And I went on in. I guess I was in the truck stop for about an hour and a half. And I come back out. It's close to morning about now. I'd say about 2 in the morning. The driver I'd asked to watch over it was still out there watching over it, standing there in front of my truck with his arms crossed and his head tilted to the side with this funny look on his face. And I strolled on over there to him. Driver's something wrong. And he was silent for a couple seconds and he looks over at me. He goes, I can't figure it out. What can't you figure out? What's up? He said, well, believe it or not, he said, everybody done went on back to their trucks. I was in my truck doing my paperwork. He said, now the corner of my eye in my left side mirror, I thought I had seen the lights on this truck, the exterior lights, come on, go on, and go off. So, just one time. I said, are you sure that's what you saw? Now, before I left Louisiana, I had to disconnect the battery, drain the fuel out of the tanks, and make sure it was secure. And I said, I reassured him. I took him over to the battery box on the passenger side of the truck. Excuse me. I opened up the battery box, and sure enough, I'm like, here you are. Yeah, batteries are disconnected. And I said, it's got no power to it. And again, I heard what he said, and I didn't totally take it for granted. I kind of put it in that folder back there. But at the same time, I didn't take it totally serious. But we both kind of had to come up with an explanation somewhat for us to be able to get back to our lives. And we settled on, it was reflections from another truck pulling in and out, whatever, it reflected off the lenses. He went back to his truck. I went back into mine. This is rattling around in my head while I'm trying to lay down and go to sleep. And I guess it spurred kind of a crazy dream where in my dream I woke up to see this truck sitting off the side of me, off my trailer, and it takes off by itself. And immediately I gave chase to it only to get down the road and it, poof, disappeared right in front of me. Again, this was in my dream, but it was enough to wake me up in a cold sweat nonetheless. And I could feel just something in the air that was telling me this wasn't totally right and there was something weird about it. I get collected and I check the truck over again. I get it back out on the road. Well, I get over into Alabama. And it just starts pouring. Yeah, I mean, it's coming down in buckets. I couldn't have gotten any more water if I'd parked under a waterfall. I caught the glimpse of a rest area sign, so I ducked it on over to the right. I'm crawling through the rest area, and I kind of had to get the truck on an angle and a turn to get it lined up in a parking stall. Well, as I'm looking in my left side mirror, make sure my trailer wheels are going to line up into the stall, I go to get my sight focused forward again, and out of the corner of my eye in my mirror, I could have sworn I seen the lights on this truck go on and off real quick. That it kind of, my stomach kind of sunk. So I kind of sat there for a second. I'm going through my internal library of common knowledge and reasoning, trying to come up with an excuse for what's apparently going on. So I'm thinking, okay, there's got to be another set of batteries on this truck somewhere. So I get my rain gear on, I get out in the rain, and I'm looking up and down, left and right, inside out, underneath, on top, everywhere. No other battery source to be found. So I'm kind of befuzzled and I go back around to the original battery box on the passenger side of the truck, and I'm looking all around, make sure there's no other hot lead. Just looked over it with a fine-tooth comb, nothing. So I go to close the battery box back up, and as I'm moving my head back up in an upright position, the corner of my eye was kind of lined up with a passenger side mirror on this truck, and I thought I had seen the interior cab light on the ceiling inside come on and go off. This has weirded me out, and I looked around behind me and around me, and I'm the only person in this rest area besides a car that was on the other side of the lot, kind of over the grass on the other side of the rest area building there. But no other humans to be seen, not out in the rain like I was, apparently. I get back in the truck, and it's just still pouring, cats and dogs and everything else. And there ain't no way I'm going to drive in this. I set my dinky alarm clock for a couple of hours, and I try to catch a nap. And I found it hard trying to fall asleep, but eventually I got there. my alarm clock didn't do its job sufficiently, and I overslept by about 5 hours, and woke up around 8:30, 9 o'clock that night to a truck air horn, and that's pretty much enough to get a corpse out of the box, if you know what I mean. It's definitely not any way you want to get woken up, because it'll just fray your nerves totally. I jolt out of the bed, I'm groggy as everything, I'm looking at my watch, I overslept. Get my boots on, because now I'm throwing the curtain open and I'm going to go out and chew somebody's head off. And I jump out of the truck, the rain stopped, and I'm looking around and there isn't another truck around me. And I have to take a mental step back again, think to myself that there ain't no way. There is no way. So I go jogging out toward the roadway to see if I can see the truck that had just got me out of bed unneededly. I get out by the roadside, by northbound lanes, a couple cars go by, but that was it, no truck to be seen. I shook my head. I'm in such disbelief at this point, and I look at that truck sitting on the back of mine. I was getting pretty close to the point to where I was going about to dump this thing off of me, because it just a weird feeling in my gut and just a weird mystique in the air and everything else. So once again, I had to get myself collected. I go back to my truck and I get my load bar out and go around, retighten the chains, and I'm putting some angry force into them. I'm just taking it out on the old truck. And I'm cussing it left and right, telling old Henry, "You ain't getting the best of me, buddy. Whether you like it or not, you're going back to Nashville." I get rounded up, get back in the truck, and I get back on up the road again. It wasn't much further, and I'm just dragging tail. I'm not able to fully wake up. I'm out of coffee, and I need coffee. I spotted an old 76 sign off the roadway, and I got off on the exit, had my fingers crossed that I was going to find a place to park. And anyway, I get into the truck stop. It's kind of one of them deals where the driveway kind of horseshoes around back of the station, and back there was a couple spots for a truck to park. Well, there's another truck there, appeared to be another driver sleeping, so I kind of parked on the opposite side as far over as I could, so not to wake anybody else up. And bad enough, I'm having the luck I am with it. So get it parked, and I go in, see if there's any coffee available. Well, there wasn't, and I had to bribe the gas station attendant $20 for her to fire up the coffee maker. So we're sitting there, it was going to take about 12-15 minutes, we're talking, and I kind of heard subliminally, in a way, multitasking, if you will, but while we're talking, I kind of, out of the far ground, I heard what sounded like another truck pulling into that lot. It was you could hear metal slapping and chains rattling. It wasn't 3, maybe 4 minutes. We're still talking, and apparently the driver to the other truck that was back there was a female. This female comes bursting through the door, hair all over the place, hysterical look on her face. And she's looking around frantically, and she sees me and comes marching over, pointing at me. "Is that your low boy out back?" "Yeah, what's up?" And she just lunges, grabs my arm, drags me out the door and back around. She's pointing at my truck. "You gotta come and see this. What's going on?" She stops and she looks right at me. She goes, "I was woken up by that truck on the back of yours, fired up, redlined the engine, and just started hopping around on that trailer trying to bust loose." Come on, you gotta be kidding me. And I really had to take a take a step back on that one, because there's no way. I look over, the truck is totally silent, sitting there all by itself. She was very insistent, and I wasn't really, again, I wasn't to the point of wanting to believe that could actually happen. Truck had no fuel in it, no power. I got her calmed down enough to where I'm like, look, I'm sorry you got woken up. I don't know what this is about, but I can prove it to you. That truck is not capable of firing up. And I led her over there. I cracked open the battery box. I showed down, pointed the flashlight down on the batteries. I said, what do you see? Well, those batteries are disconnected, I said, exactly. And there ain't no fuel in them tanks. And she kept insisting. And I wasn't to the point to where I was going to call her a liar. But, again, I heard what she said, but I was just totally discounting it. I tried to, reassure, look, go back to your truck, go back to sleep. I'll get this thing out of here. You ain't got to worry about it. So I get back in it, I pull it around to the side of the station so I can run in, get my coffee, get a hot dog to go, hopefully. And the attendant, she was all jumping about, what's going on? Do I need to call the cops? I'm like, no, calm down. Something happened out there with my truck. I made up a dumb excuse. I didn't set the brakes, it rolled forward, let it woke her up, yada, yada, yada. Got what I needed, got on out of there, got on up the road. This is all going through my mind, because when you drive a truck, you got nothing else better to do than to think. Especially when there ain't a whole lot of traffic out. Going through my library of reasoning and knowledge, and all I knew was I was going to get it back to Nashville, get it off my back, get my check, and go home. So that's basically where my... it's late. I don't even remember what time it was at this point, but... I went and looked in my mirror, and... State patrolman pulled up behind me, lights on, beeping his horn. Driver, pull over, and I'm thinking to myself, great. My bad luck just went to worse. See if I get an award this time. So I pull it over and I turn the truck off and I sit there patiently waiting for him to come tell me what I did wrong. Sure enough, he makes it up to my passenger door and just very agitated look on his face. And just starts... screaming, and he's asking me questions, but at the same time screaming, and he pulls his gun out. Driver, get out of the truck now. Okay. Got my hands up. Crawl out slowly. I do everything he tells me. Hands up, behind your head, walk back to my car, behind your back. He throws the cuffs on me. Meanwhile, I've asked him already 3 times, what did I do wrong? What did I do wrong? Nothing. Cuffs me, turns me around, leans me up against the car. Driver, who's in that truck that's sitting on your trailer? I said, officer, there's nobody in that truck. Driver, who is in the truck that's sitting on your trailer? I said, officer, I've stopped about 4 or 5 times since I've picked this thing up. I guarantee you there's nobody inside that truck. Driver, if I go up there and there's somebody in that truck, you're going under my jail tonight. You understand? At this point, I'm just ready to say the hell with it all. Whatever. Go ahead. Check it. And while as he was walking away, oh, by the way, tell Henry I said hi, will you? He turns around. Don't be a smartass. Look on his face. So he moseys on up there with his flashlight and his gun, and he's all up on looking under it and on top, and he's in and out both sides of the truck, cussing about. He's not finding nothing, scratching his head, and he can't figure out why he's not finding somebody in that truck. Well, he eventually works his way back, puts his gun away, and he walks up to me and says, well, driver, I think I owe you an apology. I said, well, before you go that far, can you first tell me why you pulled me over? And he pauses for a couple seconds and he goes, well, I was parked in the median back there when you went by me. He says, you weren't speeding. You looked okay as you were going by. So, I was going to let you go on. He said, but as soon as you went by and I got a look on the backside of you, he said, I noticed the brake lights on this truck that's on your trailer were flashing. And it wasn't hazard style. It had a rhythm to it. He said, so I jumped in and gave chase to you to see what's going on. He said, the closer I got to you, he said, I watched those taillights and I'd recognize them as Morse code, SOS. He said, so that's when I threw the lights on you, pulled you over. SOS? Are you kidding me? It's got no power. The batteries aren't connected. There's no possible way. I checked the truck a couple of times. There's no extra batteries on the truck. There's no power. Nothing connected. Driver, I don't know what to tell you. I said, bring your flashlight. And he gets the cuffs off me. We go over there with his flashlight. Prove to him, look, there is no power to this truck. Driver, are you sure there's no other battery? I am positive. And he puts his head down. He's sitting there thinking for a second. Says, well, do you have any a complaint you want to file? I said, I just want to get this truck to Nashville. He goes, driver, you have a good night. And he couldn't get out of there faster. I'm standing there on the shoulder. I've seen my share of weird things, and my temper has been tested quite a few times. And I give Bobby, my friend who put me on this job, a call. I got him out of bed. Send another driver down here. I'll meet him in Birmingham, but they're bringing it the rest of the way back. What are you talking about? What's wrong? I said, man, this thing is cursed. It's voodoo all over it, something. I said, but lights are coming on. It's starting up by itself. I got cops pulling me over. The batteries aren't connected. There's no fuel in it. Nothing. I was like, this thing is wigging me out. I'm on the verge of losing it. I said, send me a shrink while you're at it. He's like, what kind of drugs are you on, Lee? I'm telling you, there's something weird about this truck. And we went back and forth, back and forth. Eventually, he coaxed me into bringing it the rest of the way. Well, I get it back up to Nashville in the morning. I parked the trailer by one of the shop doors, so all he had to do was tilt it up and roll the thing right into the shop. And I got away from it. I parked the truck, end of it, on the other end of the lot, and I just sat there until Bobby came in the morning. I just stared at it. In that time span is when I finally had to come to terms with there is something in that truck, and it did not want to leave home. I tried to explain this stuff to Bobby. He didn't want to hear it, and when we finally got it, the truck off the trailer, if you looked on the deck, you saw 8 rectangular marks where the rear tires were setting, where it evidently was spinning out on the deck. I'm trying to put 2 and 2 together for him, and he just really wasn't hearing it. He was almost ready to send me for a drug test. But it was a really strange occurrence in my life. And since then, yeah, it's been a weird ride, but it definitely humbled me in a lot of ways, to where being human has a lot more, it makes a lot more sense, if you will. I've seen the truck one other time, actually. Last year, I was coming out of Reno in the middle of the night. And I was about the only one out on the road. I hadn't seen anybody for a while. And I looked in my mirror, and a truck came up over the hill behind me, coming up on me. And I get on the radio and try to get the driver on it. And tell him, go ahead and get in the left lane. Well, wasn't getting nobody on the radio, and the closest truck got, I could tell it was an older KW. I thought, huh, So he got a little closer, and the closer he got, the more I noticed this was the same paint job on that truck of old Henry. And my stomach just hit my feet. I'm like, oh man. And I keep looking in my mirror, and I'm still trying for the driver on the radio, nothing. And as the truck is going by me at 10 clicks faster than me, I noticed all the windows were mirror tinted like aviator sunglasses, so you couldn't see in. But I just kept right on getting it with a flatbed of coils, and I flashed them anyway with the lights, telling me to come back over from the left lane, honked the horn and flashed me back, and just kept right on going. So whether there was a driver in at that time or not, I have no idea, but it wouldn't surprise me nonetheless. There you go. Hope you enjoyed it. And like I said, I'm much rather would have done it this way. I tried to type it out, but it was way, way too long. But enjoy your show. I'm going to keep on listening. And have a good one, Lex. Have a good one, listeners. I'm Lee, and I'm out of here. Later.
If you want to hear more stories like Lee in Delaware's haunted truck story, a very popular Anything Ghost story from about 10 years ago, then you need to join the Anything Goes VIP group. There's a one-time membership fee, and you'll have access to the complete 14-year archive with stories like Lee's, or with the interview with Al Robber that I talked about earlier in the show. So become a member of the Anything Goes VIP group. For more information, go to www.anythingghost.com and then go to the Become VIP link. Anythingghost.com, Become VIP. And that'll do it for show number 277. And if you want to share a story, a true ghost story, or a local ghost legend will do too. Either record it yourself or type it up and send it to Lex at anythingghost.com, or there's a form at anythingghost.com that you can fill out. Thanks everyone for all your stories, and I'll talk to you in show number 278 of Anything Ghost coming up next month. Talk to you then. Have yourself a wonderful, safe week. Take care.